As far as I know, this is the only time in Airbnb's history where anyone was given executive mandate to go redesign and rebuild the whole thing. And so we got to ask all these big questions. And we're like, well, okay, this is getting somewhere interesting. How might we then this? How might we then this? There was friction, there were concerns, and then we just go back, right? How do we mitigate these concerns? Are these just assumptions that we haven't asked ourselves about in 10 years? Maybe we should go run some more tests or do some more research to really challenge ourselves to find something that is a step function better user experience.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is with Ryan Scott, who was one of the early designers at DoorDash and went on to spend years as a design lead at Airbnb. Nowadays, Ryan teaches hundreds of designers, ranging from seniors to VPs, all about how to make a bigger impact at their company. So this episode is jam-packed with insights about navigating pushback, framing your ideas, and everything that Ryan learned leading a massive redesign of the Airbnb booking flow. But first, I asked Ryan to take us into the room and share a little bit about what it's like presenting at Airbnb Crit.
I think there's a couple adjectives that came to mind. Firstly, like the level of detail oriented you have to be. You have to be so incredibly detail oriented because Brian's a designer. And so that trickles down to everyone where, you know, you've got your manager and then a director, and then you've got Alex Schleifer, the chief design officer when I was there, and then you've got Brian. And so everyone is orienting towards that. But Brian is the type of designer and CEO who will notice when something's optically misaligned. Like, you probably aligned it correctly in Figma, but the curve of the O is just off by 3 pixels. He's going to notice that. And so you have to be like so crisp on everything. And it's not just the product design work itself. It's the presentation of the work also has to be incredibly dialed in. It's almost like working at an agency and you're presenting to a client. You want there to be transitions. You want the flow to be perfect. There has to be a really strong narrative. So you kind of start from the top and you work your way towards the details. And then he can ask questions in any number of directions. And Alex was that way and other people were that way as well. So that was really one thing that kind of permeated the culture. I think there was also another aspect that was interesting to me that kind of shook me when I first got there, which was the expectations and the kind of lack of swim lanes with some of the questions that I would get in Crit. One of my first memories, I was at Airbnb for maybe 2 weeks. I had just started, just getting my feet wet, totally fish out of water, different type of culture entirely. And what we would do is there would be a design stand-up and Alex would be there and every other designer would be there in this famous circular room at Airbnb. And we'd all go around for 15 seconds and just say what we were working on. So everyone had awareness. And then if we wanted to make connections with people and say, oh, you're working on that, I'm working on this, we should talk, it gave a forum to do that. And so this is my first time doing it. And I'm talking about what I'm working on. And I barely know what I'm working on. And Alex says, that's great. When is that going to ship? And I was like, oh, that's a very specific question for a PM. I don't know. I'll get back to you. And I tried to like, be like, man, I just started 2 weeks ago. Can you let me off the hook a little bit? But that's the type of question you would get where it's like you as a design lead or a design leader at Airbnb, like you should be aware of the full spectrum of the project, right? Not just the design aspects, but all aspects of when this is shipping, what's the roadmap, what comes next. All of that is going to be fair game. And so you have to be incredibly well-versed in every aspect of the strategy and the timeline and what metrics you expect to hit. All of it could be asked at any moment. And so you just have to be incredibly aware and conscious and prepared. And that might sound really intimidating, but when you get used to it, it kind of becomes second nature. And then when you go anywhere, you just talk in a different way, you present in a different way. And it's actually a really incredible superpower to develop.
So I recently did an episode with Noam Segal, who's a longtime research leader at Airbnb, Wealthfront, Twitter. And he kept raving about this new product called Genway that he was using in his current role at Upwork. Now, it uses AI-powered interviews to help you gather really rich qualitative data at basically an infinite scale. And I tried it out. I liked the product
so much that I decided to use Genway to gather feedback from people listening to the show. So if you have a few minutes, it's kind of fun. Head to dive.club/interview and you can get a little taste of what the future of research looks like. That's dive.club/interview. Okay, now on with the episode.
Okay, so let's say that you have a presentation at the end of the week and you're sitting down at your computer. Talk us through your process of figuring out what artifact to create, like what are you going to actually share, and then how are you going to effectively frame your ideas?
The first thing I'm always going to start with is, who is my audience? Am I presenting to my team? Am I presenting to my PM, this kind of close proximity, or my manager? Am I presenting to the whole company or the whole design team? Am I presenting to Brian or to Alex, right? If it's a really broad audience, I'm going to want to provide a lot of upfront context. If there's a lot of people who don't know anything about what I'm talking about, this is what we're trying to solve. This is the problem. This is how we know it's a problem. Here's the solutions we've considered. This is why we're heading in this direction. We feel really confident for these reasons. We still have these questions that we're not certain about. If you have any questions for us or context that we need to know from your team, please reach out to me. That's the type of format I would take in these broader audiences. If it's someone like Alex, you might have a very little amount of time with him, or Brian, you might have a very little amount of time. You might have like 30-minute check-in once a month. So you'd probably still want to refresh his memory and say, here's what we're working on. This is what this project is. This is why this matters. Cause you probably have been thinking about the future IPO and not been thinking about my project as much as I have been for the last month. But then you're going to want to get into, here's specifically why we're in this meeting right now, why this is worth 30 minutes of your time. And the best thing you can do to start with is, here's what we need from you. We need you to green light this. We need to hear if you have any concerns. We need to get your specific feedback on this, this, and this. We have conflict with this team and we need someone to be a tiebreaker. Like, why are you in that meeting with them? So that context helps them land. It helps them orient themselves. And then making it really relevant to them. And then you can start jumping into, you know, the problem and some of the solutions. Sometimes you jump right into the solutions and you're going to show like, here's pixels, pixels, pixels. Sometimes you ease your way into that a little bit. But those are the factors really that come to mind for me of, who am I talking to? What do they need to know? What feedback do I need from them to be able to move forward? And how do I set them up to give me that feedback as effectively as possible, so it's not a waste of their time? I get what I need coming out of this, and we can move forward really efficiently.
I love the specificity of your ask. Like, you're really going beyond, hey, what do you think about this? What's your feedback? And like making it really clear, like, this is what we need from you. This is the priority.
Yeah. And the great thing about that is that being really specific puts guardrails on other people too, right? So you're specific. I'm talking to Brian, but I want to shape the conversation in a way that stays focused. And that means other people aren't hijacking the conversation and taking it in a different direction. It's like bowling. Here are the bumpers on the bowling lane. Like, we're not going to go in the gutter. We're not going to go over there. We're going to stay here as much as possible. It creates a precedent, and then you can like reel people back in if you need to get things back on track because you started the meeting with that framing.
I want to get like really, really into the weeds for a second. How do the things that you're talking about show up in the way that you are designing your decks and presentations? Like, are there specific ways that you think designers can improve, like, the visuals that they're actually showing? Maybe they're even doing it remotely and sharing their screen on Zoom. Or are there just like, you know, tactics or just things that you have added to your own process over, you know, doing this so many times and putting the reps in?
The tactic that's worked really well for me, and I do this in interviews too, which has worked really well, is basically have one thought per slide. It's, if you look at Apple's website, it's such an interesting case study. As you scroll down, they're fantastic at just having like an image and a headline and a bullet, and you're just in that moment focused on that one thing they want to say to you. it's funny when I create like a presentation, I'll have like a 20-minute presentation. I'll have like 87 slides. It's because I don't even have presenter notes because I'm going through them kind of so quickly. Some of that's transitions, but often it's because I want to have like every sentence sometimes even has its own slide with the visual. So I'm staying really carefully on track because I'm moving forward. People are really engaged because it's constantly moving forward, but there is never this like, I'm going to sit and dwell on this one slide for 20 minutes and there's 45 bullet points and there's too much information. That's again where you start to lose track of that very linear flow of a narrative, is when there's just too much going on. And so my favorite tactic is to really tighten that up and make sure that there's people can only really focus on the thing I want them to focus on in that moment, because there just is nothing else. The other thing is, by getting them to focus on the visuals and keeping the visuals as clean as possible in a lot of situations, I also then want them to take in the visuals, read a little bit of text, see the headline, look at the design, and then listen to me and come back to what I'm saying, because I'm providing them, you know, that context. And so that helps keep focus, that helps keep everyone, you know, paying attention. People's minds don't start to wander, and that can really make a huge difference.
So you talked a little bit about how the context that you're giving is tied to how broad an audience that you're speaking to. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the stage of the design process and how that might impact your presentation and what you're actually sharing. Obviously, there's a level of visual fidelity that is tied to how fleshed out is this idea, but are there other ways that you're tweaking your framing based off of where you're at in your own thinking?
I'm a big fan of no fidelity, like high fidelity, low fidelity, and let's take it all the way to the other end of no fidelity. And it can just be an idea, right? What if we completely redesigned Airbnb? What if we have got this 10-year-old booking flow that has so much UX debt in it? What if we started over? You know, designers can be very provocative by asking those questions. And for designers, it's cheap for us to ask that question. It's great to just, we lead a brainstorm or something, and there maybe is no visual output, or we're not starting with a visual, but we can lead a cross-functional effort to get people thinking in a different way. That can really set the stage to then, once you get into the pixels and you start actually designing, you've got some alignment and, or at least some kind of precedent you've set of like, we're thinking big about this. They're thinking about, what if we started over? I should expect to see some directions along those lines. So if you think about starting from no fidelity, you're starting with an idea, the framing has to be really oriented. You can't, you know, be responding to pixels because there aren't any yet. You can't be talking about the flow because there isn't one yet. You might be able to talk about some of those problems if you have an existing product and you can surface that. But I think there's also kind of business problems start to become really relevant at that stage. Are we missing out on opportunities because we're not improving this? Are we losing market share because we're not improving this? Are people, churning, or is retention lower because we're not working on this? A lot of those kind of PME type questions, I think, are extremely relevant for designers, because that's what kicks off the projects that eventually you end up working on. And so if designers want to lead, I think those are the right questions to be asking. What metrics are we seeing drop? What does that represent in terms of how humans are behaving? And then how might we do something bigger or different to start reacting to that, or preventing that, or addressing that, or taking advantage of this opportunity we have? What's going on with competitors or the market? I think those are great ways to start and great questions to ask. And those questions are really safe places for non-designers to participate. Most people in a business are business people. They're not design people. And so if you're talking about, hey, we're thinking about this behavior, we're seeing a problem in this product, we think it's going to affect retention, are you willing to have a conversation about that? That's a safe place for people and a comfortable place for other people to participate. If you just jump into, here's the user flow, there's a bunch of friction, that's where can be things that get lost in translation. There's a little bit of difficulty like jumping right from my world as a marketer or a PM into the pixels and the colors and the things. I think that's a way to help bring people along.
I love the phrase PME questions. It makes total sense. And I think it's like actually a measuring stick that designers can use to identify the level of strategic input that they're actually having in the company. Like, are you asking these questions? Yes or no? Or are you waiting to have more of an execution focused conversation where the opportunity has already kind of been handed to you and now you're just trying to figure out how to quote unquote solve the problem?
Yeah. And what I've found too is I think designers often, there are companies that have a culture with very set swim lanes where it's like, no, that's what the PMs do. Don't go ask that question. What I found is that a lot of times, like PMs and business people get really excited when designers start talking and thinking that way, because now they have a partner. They've got someone who's not off in their pixel world. They've got someone who's like, you know, I was thinking about this retention problem we have. I've worked with so many PMs who are like, yes, like I've got one of those designers. All right. And so I think that it's great to start talking in that way and see how people respond. And a lot of times I've seen people respond so positively.
Okay, so let's speak to a very specific listener then who is hearing you talk and they're recognizing the fact that like, yeah, I'm downstream. I'm in execution mode. I just wait to get my next PRD and they want to break that trend. How should they think about the right question to ask and even to identify the areas where they should be even looking for questions?
There can be this perception in companies that designers are kind of like off in pixel land, that that's where we want to be and we don't care about the big picture. And I've spoken to designers like this. They're like, look, I just want to stay focused on the pixels and the craft. That's okay. But often companies are receptive to when we go bigger. And so I think the first thing you can do is show some curiosity towards what are these metrics? Why do we care about them? Where are they coming from? What do they mean? How does my work impact them? Start by just asking those questions. Start by really, truly, authentically wanting to understand the answers to them. That is a great place to start. And that can unlock a lot on its own. You know, if design has this kind of brand in many organizations that we don't care about those things, and some designers don't, or we think that, you know, business is dirty in some way and we're the craft artsy people. I literally saw someone on LinkedIn talk about the other side, which I thought was so interesting. It's like designers and the other side. What was fascinating to me about that framing was it makes us versus them, which is not a good position for designers to be in, because even at like the largest organizations with the largest design teams, designers are always going to be a minority when you're working in-house at a tech company. So this us versus them mentality is never going to serve you. And so you need to make it us and us. It needs to all be one team. And the best way you can start to break that down is to show curiosity and sensitivity and interest in the same things that other people are very motivated by. It is completely legitimate and acceptable to want to drive those metrics. It is acceptable and important for a business to have profits. And appreciating that and learning how to talk about your designs and how they relate to those things and drive those things, that's a place to start. And then you can start to unlock that trust. You can start to unlock that credibility. And that's going to provide different opportunities.
Unlocking credibility is an interesting phrase that kind of jumped out to me. Can you just unpack a little bit about what you mean by that?
I think you see the symptoms of what you describe as maybe design not being as credible in some organizations, where design is an afterthought, where design is brought along after many of the strategic decisions have been made. And this relates really strongly to that execution mode of like, hey, you know what? The CEO made some strategic directions. The PMs have shaped a bunch of things. Here's your doc. Make it pretty before you hand it off to engineering. That to me seems like a symptom of not having the right credibility to participate earlier in that conversation. That it can be political. It can be that people further upstream don't want to invite others into that conversation, and the way they're incentivized or the type of culture that you exist and operate in is competitive, and we want to have these silos so I can very carefully say this is the value I deliver. There are those types of companies. But there are companies that succeed being more cross-functional, but they still, you know, culturally cross-functional, but they still get stuck in this operational model. And so one thing I think a lot about is I only have control over me. I can't control other people. I can't control the whole organization. And so what I want to do is say, all right, let's at least remove my contribution to this as a variable in me participating in the organization. So I want to develop that credibility. I want to be able to participate in those conversations, but to be able to participate in those conversations, there are things as a designer that I have not been taught, that the boot camp didn't teach me, that my graphic design degree didn't teach me. I want to understand some of these things more deeply and better and be able to speak that language. It's just not a skill set that we're traditionally given. One thing that's interesting about my background is I actually went and got my MBA from Berkeley while I was at Airbnb, also during the pandemic, also while I had my first child. So like not the best timing, but was absolutely worth doing. And it was quite expensive. And I call it the like most expensive ethnographic study I've ever run. There were 300 people in my class. There was one other designer. So I'm mostly around marketing people and economists and like a whole wide spectrum of people who work in totally different businesses outside of tech. Just being around those types of people, you see how, at least I can speak from my experience, like my design education did not prepare me to be in. There are just huge knowledge gaps if you come out of a boot camp or you come out of a design degree that are worth filling. And when you do fill those gaps, that's where I really think unlocking credibility comes from, is I can walk into the room and have a conversation about the unit economics of something and say, all right, well, now we're going to pivot our strategy as a product team or change the design in this way because I understand how it's going to affect the economic output for the business, knowing that we're fundraising in 6 months, and tying all of those big pieces back down to the pixels. That's that credibility unlock. If I can go into that room and have that conversation and know just enough to participate and talk to people on their level and show them that I care about what they spend all day, every day doing. I care enough to understand it and to really want to learn it and to be able to connect my work to their work.
I think most people listening to this are not going to go get their MBA, but there might be some curiosity about some of these knowledge gaps that you're talking about. So having gone through that experience, what are like the most important either skills or mental models that you've acquired that you think can help designers speak this language?
Yeah, I think there are three kind of meta themes when I think about what is most important. When I think about developing influence, the first things that come to mind are marketing and negotiation. Like every time you're in a meeting, and this is what we started this conversation with, it was, who is my audience? If you think about anything you're pitching, whether it's design as a function, we should have more designers, or designers should be part of the conversation more, whether it's a specific product solution, whatever it is you're pitching, you are selling in that moment a product. You're selling something to an audience and you need them to buy whatever it is you're selling. So, you know, come to marketing, like segmentation, targeting, positioning. How are we thinking about the executives versus the managers versus the PMs? How are we thinking about those groups differently? How are we aligning our messaging to them in a way that resonates? And negotiation is a huge skill that, especially when it comes to positions and interests, what's really driving people and their perspectives when they're pushing back against your design? They might be saying one thing, but it's coming from a totally different place. And so when it comes to influence, I think marketing and negotiation skills are huge places to focus. The other thing that when it comes to credibility, I think bigger picture thinking and really understanding how the business as a whole is operating and moving and the kind of huge winds that are pushing the organization one direction or another. The two things I think about are economics and strategy. So strategy is the relationship between our organization and all the other organizations. Is that person a partner or a competitor? You know, are we going to acquire them? Like, how are we as an organization positioning ourselves in this landscape? And then you know, I took economics during COVID when supply chain shut down and inflation started to rise. Having some like sense of the bigger picture, the macroeconomic environment, that when, you know, inflation starts to increase, you're going to increase rates, and increasing interest rates, I'll give you a little macroeconomic primer, Increasing interest rates is like turning on the light at a party, you know, at the end of the night. You go to a club or a bar and they turn on the light and everyone's like, get out, the party's over. That's exactly what raising interest rates is like when you have high inflation. It's like, party's over, you guys got to calm down now. That makes money expensive. And so companies are going to change how they invest. They might have layoffs. You might see them laying off one part of the org and hiring in another. You can start to anticipate what might happen at your company if you're looking at, all right, like interest rates are going up. You know, this sector is going to really struggle. Consumer spending might change. Jobs might change. You can kind of start to sense what the priorities of your organization might be, and how some of those things might change. So I think from a big picture standpoint, like having some sense of macroeconomics and strategy is all about the environment in which your business operates and how it's kind of always moving and positioning in that environment, because that environment is also always changing.
You talked about navigating pushback from leaders. So I'm wondering if we can go a little bit deeper into your different strategies that you can use to effectively defend your designs. Because in my experience, a common reason that my ideas would get shot down is because an executive would look at them and say, you know, that's too risky. Like, we can't afford that. We don't have an appetite for that level of risk. So maybe we could even start by talking about how you would mitigate risk in a stakeholder's mind when you're presenting your ideas.
Yeah. I think risk is a factor, and you'll hear that a lot. I think the other two things that come into business decision making are value and cost. So that's that kind of ROI concept of like, what's the bang for our buck? How much are we going to get if we do this? But then there is that risk factor. How likely are we to fail? You know, have we mitigated some of these things? So thinking about mitigating risk, a lot of times the concern about risk also, all these things are related. The concern about risk is also related to, are we actually going to get enough value? Because people, human beings, and you look at this in psychology with gambling, they're willing to take some risks if the reward is sufficiently high, right? And it's like a 2-to-1 relationship. We hate loss. And so if you're like, you know, either lose a dollar or you win a dollar, I'm not going to make that bet. But if I could win $10, if I bet $1, I'm probably going to make that bet. And so there is a degree of risk aversion. You can overcome that by describing the total amount of value that something might have. So there's that first. If you still need to mitigate risk, that's where a lot of tools in the designer's toolkit come really handy. That's the purpose of competitive analysis or market research or user research, is to say risk is usually we don't know. It's an X factor. And that's why it's so scary. You know, it's like, what is the probability if I go swimming in the ocean, I'm going to be attacked by a shark? I don't know. So therefore, I better play it safe. You're like, but this is a lake. There aren't any sharks. You're like, oh, okay, fine. I'll go swimming. You know, it's like, it's the what if, it's the undefined. And so what I would do is try to define it. Say, okay, what don't we know? What would we need to know to feel more confident moving forward? Instead of greenlighting this whole project, can we greenlight some investigation into seeing how risky is this? And if it is risky, how would we mitigate it? And then how costly would those mitigations be? I've definitely been in situations where we spend more time talking about how risky something might be than it would take to just go ask 100 people and find out like, oh no, users won't behave that way. They're very excited about this. And then you've mitigated that risk. So I think that really focusing on the methods for mitigation, really focusing on usually research, digging in deeper in some capacity, and doing that in a cost-effective way are really great ways to start.
I love the idea of asking, like, what would we need to know in order for you to have the confidence level to greenlight that? Like, that's such a simple and effective way to give leaders the ability to hedge their yes, basically.
Absolutely. And it's a very specific question. What do we need to know? What don't we know? What would we need to do to go find more information? When people are afraid, when they sense risk, and this is just evolutionarily, biologically, how humans behave, when we assess risk, we're going to fight or flight. We're going to start to shut down. We're going to start to do this mental math of, you know, what could this cost me if I screw up this big product? Am I going to get fired? Am I going to not get that promotion? Right. And if there's too many what ifs, I'm going to play it a lot safer. And so by taking that intangible thing and making it more tangible by saying, how are we tactically going to mitigate this now? What do we need to learn? What questions do we need to ask? How can we do that in a cost-effective way? That gets people out of this, I don't know, this is scary, this is too abstract mode, and gets that brain into problem-solving mode of, well, we just went and talked to 20 people, then we would feel pretty confident that we're doing the right thing. A good example of this is we wanted to launch a feature at DoorDash, and it was for Dasher Instant Pay. And I was a big proponent of this. I was the one really pitching this at the company. You know, I did a lot of analysis. I'm like, look, competitively, our pay structure for drivers was not competitive. Like Uber paid out faster for people. Amazon paid out faster for people. Lyft paid out faster for people. Grubhub paid out faster. And DoorDash, we were processing all of our payments once weekly. If you think about who drives on DoorDash, a lot of those people are just trying to make ends meet and pay their bills. And so if you're like, nope, you have to wait until 4 p.m. on Monday because that's when we process all of our payments, that's not a great value prop for them. And we're potentially going to lose drivers and lose supply to other people who provide that more immediate return on you getting on the road. And so, you know, I did some analysis and said, look, we are like one of the least competitive. We can be more competitive in this way. But there still wasn't a lot of support from the organization to move forward with that. And so one of the first things I did was just go on a Facebook group of drivers and said, would you be interested in this? And I launched a survey and it was like 85% of people said yes. And that was just enough to say like, okay, we're getting some very lightweight feedback, but it's positive signal. And it was enough for the PM to be like, all right, let's at least move the ball down the field. It's not necessarily a big like, yes, we should definitely do this now, but we've mitigated enough of that risk to keep asking more questions and keep doing more research so the project doesn't get shut down. It continues to incrementally move forward, but that's all it took was a survey on a Facebook group to just keep the ball moving forward.
It really speaks to the value of having just a little bit of quantifiable data to support your argument versus having none at all.
Absolutely. And you think doing competitive analysis, it's a very like MBA way of thinking, like I'm going to look at all the competitors and create a spreadsheet would be enough. You kind of have to put together sometimes multiple different methods. And if you've got some competitive analysis and a piece of data and a quote, that really tells the story. And, you know, even if it was collected in a very simple way, even if it's not statistically significant, it can be enough to keep the conversation going. And that's sometimes what you need.
That was what I was going to say too, is having even just one quote, like the difference between zero quotes and one quotes in a deck is such a big deal. Like one of the things that I've done to kind of evolve my practice over the last 5 years or so is I became obsessed with organizing user quotes because they're like the designer's best friend. Like that is how you get people to like really feel the pain of what you're talking about is it's like, here's my slide. And it's like 50% of that screen is just a quote that someone else said. And I try to put those everywhere now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's you hit the nail on the head. It's I feel differently. You can look at the numbers and you will use the numbers to rationalize the business decision. At Airbnb, one of the big pitches I had was we should rebuild and redesign the entire booking flow right before the IPO. Like very sensitive timing to propose blowing up a 10-year-old legacy system and starting over. And, you know, there was no one thing that made that pitch successful. But one tool I used was this quote we had from research, and someone said, this is literally what I have to go through to book on Airbnb. And it's like, I just put that everywhere because that went all the way up to Brian. That went to everybody because it's like people were just baffled by, is this many steps? Is that really necessary? And then I, you know, could break down mental models and how things, you know, conventionally are purchased in e-commerce and what patterns you use and how we're violating those expectations, et cetera, et cetera. But you can start with that quote and it just turns everyone's head. And then you're like, all right, let's analyze this further. Data, 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 you know, example, example, competitor, competitor. And it starts off that conversation.
Okay, let's talk about that booking project then, because and that's about as high stakes as it gets. Like it's like the conversion funnel of the entire company, pre-IPO, huge opportunity, but also like you really can't mess this up. And something that I saw you talk about was the importance of two design sprints that you ran early in the process with like 40 mm-hmm. key people at the company. I guess my question is, what were some of the things that you were doing to drive alignment throughout that design process?
It was a really interesting experience. And to provide a little context on this, that crazy project spawned out of an even crazier project, which was redesigning Airbnb's entire mobile website. Mm. So basically the mandate was go redesign all of Airbnb in a year and rebuild the whole thing. Like, and so we had a new design language system we wanted to experiment with that we were testing out. Really good opportunity to drive that. Really good opportunity to kind of kick the tires and say, how might we improve things more holistically instead of like incrementally one at a time? And we got four designers and eight engineers and a PM, and in a year, go rebuild the entire platform. And as far as I know, this is the only time in Airbnb's history where anyone was given executive mandate to go redesign and rebuild the whole thing, because everyone kind of worked in their teams. And so you'd have a booking team and a messaging team, and everyone stayed on their surface. We got to look at all of those surfaces horizontally on the mobile website platform. And so we got to ask all these big questions. And so to answer your question, the starting point was some degree of executive mandate to go exploring, go dig up what's going on here and propose some new ideas. The way you phrase it, I think it's really interesting, like driving alignment. I think the term I would use is cultivating alignment, where it's like, I don't want to be the driver. I don't want to be pushing. I want to be like teasing out from people, what do they care about? And in their wildest dreams, what did they want to do with their surfaces? Because all of these designers and all these PMs still owned their messaging tool, their booking tool, all these different people. But we came in as this like horizontal tiger team and got to ask these big questions. And so I didn't know anything about booking. And so the first thing I started with was, you all are the experts. I want to ask some questions, but I really need to understand everything you know. And help me understand everything you care about. So we're aligned. I know what your priorities are. And tell me all your hopes and dreams. You know, like, what do you wish you could do? If you could just start over, what would that be like? How would that look? And so really what I try to do was bring in these people who were almost like consultants to me, where I was just asked, Ryan, go look at the booking flow and see what you think we should do. And so I kind of recruited all these people to be my advisors. And then I proposed, like I said, very low and no fidelity solutions and said, here's a problem. Here's what I think we could do about it. Here's a problem. Here's an incredibly rough, ugly wireframe of an idea we might want to pursue, just to make it accessible to people, just to make sure people were feeling like I'm not coming in and taking over their space that they own, but they are equal partners in this like new, exciting discovery and exploration process. And so that was that first phase of this project, was building those alliances, like kind of assembling an unofficial team of people who were invested in this. And then what happened was we showed some ideas to Alex Schleifer, and the kind of feedback was, that's great. What if we pushed further? And Alex had a great quote that I'll never forget. He said, like, the booking numbers might drop, but that's an investment we're willing to make. We wanted to, and I thought that framing was brilliant, of like, the numbers may go down, that might cost us something to make this change, but we're willing to eat that cost for a period of time because we think there's a greater global maximum. We think we're going to achieve something far more significant. And so Alex was really the catalyst of like, let's make this official. Let's really go deep on this. And that's where we then had an actual team kind of get assembled behind this. And we did a more iterative, we did two versions. We did a more iterative version and we pitched it, and we did a more extreme version and we pitched it. And I was really advocating for the extreme version. And what the extreme version was let's take a flow that is multiple steps and multiple variable steps. If you're booking a home in China and you're doing it on the mobile website platform and you're a new user, you're going to have a very different experience than if you're booking on iOS and you have booked on Airbnb all the time and you're going to California. Like, you know, the experiences were completely different, which is not really what you want. And so the iterative version was, let's keep a flow. The extreme version was, why do we need a flow? Why can't we do this all on one single page that sets expectations and flexes with the variability that we can't always eliminate. If you're going to China, the Chinese government is going to want legal documents from you. You're going to have to upload your passport. We can't, as a company, get around that. We just have to accommodate that friction as necessary. And so that was how that project evolved, was then we got to, you know, have a bigger question of like, what if we pushed further? And luckily, Airbnb was a type of culture where you could ask those big questions. And we just kind of never stopped asking those big questions. That's where we started. And we're like, well, okay, this is getting somewhere interesting. How might we then this? How might we then this? There was friction, there were concerns. And then we just go back, right? How do we mitigate these concerns? How do we, you know, test? Are these just assumptions that we haven't asked ourselves about in 10 years? And maybe we should look at data we have. Maybe we should look at some of those quotes that we have. Maybe we should go run some more tests or do some more research to really challenge ourselves to find something that is a step function better user experience.
Are you able to share if the metrics went up or down? And why do you think that Alex and team made the commitment to invest in something, even if the metrics do go down? Because I think that's a situation that a lot of designers find themselves in, where you get so invested in this idea. Maybe you have numbers and quotes and you've built this case that is, you know, relatively bulletproof, and you ship something and then there's either no change or it goes down. Then what?
On the mobile website project, I think almost every A/B test we launched was negative, but there was so much debt, right? The experience was so poor. The pages took so long to load. On that overall mobile website project, the conversion was so much lower than iOS. It was so much lower than industry standard. They were like, all right, these things are already low. There must be a better way. And so the metaphor I like to use is, if you've ever watched a movie where there's like a heist, there's always someone at a vault, like listening very carefully, mm-hmm. and trying to get the tumblers just right. And a lot of times A/B testing is like one tumbler at a time. You get the first tumbler and then, or like the second tumbler, but you're like, didn't unlock the vault yet. And you're like, that didn't have any value. Let's start over. And it's like, no. Sometimes these things have to happen like in sequence. It has to be enough, right? You have to get like multiple things simultaneously. So we had done these like A/B tests, and we kind of like tried to like incrementally stair step our way to a better solution. Everything's negative. So I think eventually we were like, screw it. We just like made things the way we thought they needed to be, and then launched like one big A/B test to say, like, if we redesign the whole experience from the ground up and we got rid of like all the debt and we did all the things, instead of trying to piecemeal our way towards like bad experience, magic experience, we just tried to go to magic experience. And so I think that was one thing of like, we often, the way I think about this and the lesson that I learned was many times, and I think two things. One, many times those numbers are going to be negative until they're not. And you have to have conviction that it's worth moving forward. I think a lot of teams see that those numbers go down and they get scared and they stop, and they're risking their promotion, or an executive is going to be upset, or whatever it is. This was just clearly a bad idea. Sometimes the numbers going down is, well, we should keep moving forward. We're not there yet. We haven't unlocked all the tumblers to open the vault to get to the gold inside. So what we should do is keep unlocking tumblers, not just back away, you know? And so I think that sometimes for me was, if we have competitive analysis, if we have user research, if all of these other signals are telling me that this is worth pursuing, let's keep pursuing it. So that was like one big kind of perspective shift, I think, for me, that was really useful and helped me get teams aligned. I think the other thing that really helped was also setting expectations going into this, that these numbers may be negative. And if they're negative, here are some hypotheses already why they might be negative. Well, we chose to cut corners here. We chose to cut scope there. We never validated this assumption. So if it's negative, here are some like six hypotheses why, and a roadmap for what we will do to make sure that those things aren't actually contributing to this being a negative test. That really helped say, yep, negative metrics happen. That's okay. We have a plan, but we're going to keep moving forward with mitigating those negative metrics, not back away from the entire project.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode.
I love the idea of proactively calling out the reasons that a project might result in negative outcomes. Also, the safe-cracking metaphor is one of my favorites that someone has ever shared on the show. I will definitely be repurposing that as my own ingenuity. I want to talk a little bit more about when it makes sense to invest in UX debt, because everything that you're talking about, it makes sense because it's pretty easy to connect anything that you're doing in the realm of like a booking or a checkout flow to these most important business metrics. You know, nothing moves the bottom line more at Airbnb than this booking flow. But how can designers reframe something like investing in UX debt when it's a little bit less obvious how it is connected to like a core monetization flow?
Yeah, I think one thing that was really interesting to me out of my MBA, and I remember this moment in my finance course, and all of us looked at each other like our heads had exploded, was that not all debt is actually bad. And I think in UX, we talk about UX debt as this like negative thing that has to be addressed. And I think that comes from a place of craft, where there's this kind of mixed incentive where designers are pulled in two different directions. You're pulled in the direction from your managers and the design team and design culture in the industry that craft is key. That's how you're going to get hired. That's how other designers are going to evaluate you. And then at the same time, your business is saying, cut those corners. Let's ship this stuff. And so you do get stuck in this world. To start with, not all debt is bad. And in finance, when you think about good debt versus bad debt, it's really about cost benefit. Am I willing to accept some degree of debt? Because it's going to unlock so much more value. And so for me, I just had to be okay with sometimes accruing some debt if it pays off more value. A great example, like a traditional personal finance example, is like a credit card with 25% compounding interest is really bad debt. That's going to accrue really quickly. It's going to get out of control. It's a really high rate. And you're going to be just swimming in tens of thousands of dollars versus a debt. A 2% mortgage on a home is you've made an investment and you're going to pay some interest on that, but that interest is going towards something that may accrue value faster than the interest. So that's an example of bad debt versus good debt. And I think we need to talk about debt in that way, and UX debt included, in that way of like, is this bad UX debt or is it okay UX debt? And I don't like the UX debt because it's affecting my like identity as a designer and my desire to have craft. And am I going to add this to my portfolio to get hired because I don't want to work here anymore? That is all legitimate, but that can be our own incentives for wanting to push towards those things. I think the divide between acceptable debt and bad debt is it unlocking value or is it blocking value? And you can see that shift happens slowly over time, where you've like cut a corner and you did a quick MVP and a quick 0 to 1, and it unlocked a huge amount of business value and everyone's happy. And then you do it again and again and again and again and again, and that debt builds and builds and builds and builds. And at some point, and I'm sure most designers have been there, like the engineers are like, well, look, we built the back end this way for the last 8 years, and now we cannot change anything else until we refactor, right? That's the, we've accrued debt in maybe sometimes incrementally an okay way on a decision by decision basis until it became now so painful, we have to pay that debt off in a really big way. A lot of organizations operate that way, and that is, you should just expect that that's the way it happens sometimes. the tipping point I would look for is, are we starting to be blocked from value? That is not a good position for a business to be in. It's like, we can't compete with our competitors. We can't launch as quickly. We just can't build the same features that other people are building to stay competitive. Those are all things that strategically are going to start preventing the business from succeeding. So I would look for those things of like, look, if we don't resolve some of this now, it's going to cost us in the future projects that we're able to do. One tactic that's worked well for me, and it's kind of paradoxical, is that a lot of times with debt, I try to make my ask as a designer very small. And when you think about business decisions, it's that value versus cost, that ROI of, if I just, as a designer, made my ask small, it cost very little. I'm like, look, there's 17 different button styles. Can we just make one button style? I just want to change the colors, you know, just the one little thing. Can we just do the one little thing? And the PMs were like, nope, that's not important. We're moving on. That little ask had little value. And what's difficult for designers, and difficult especially when you think about the context of A/B testing, is so much of design's value is immeasurable because it matters in aggregate. It's all of those little things adding up together. You can't test, you know, this color versus that color on a button always, or like, you know, the 4 pixel radius versus the 10 pixel radius. It has no impact when you're measuring in that way. But when all of those decisions build up together, it's like, yeah, our app looks like crap though, and now no one knows how to use it. It's like, okay, then there's that breaking point moment. So the paradoxical thing that I realized was that by making my asks small, they were easier to dismiss. By making bigger asks and rolling a bunch of little asks into maybe something larger, the value was also potentially larger, and then the business people could understand. I think the best example is that mobile website project for Airbnb, which is like, the whole business needs to continue growing if we're going to IPO in a couple years. We are missing out on potential growth opportunities in other markets. We are underperforming competitors. This is a huge thing. We should redesign the whole platform. It wasn't like, go fix a piece of it or go fix some buttons. It was like, there needs to be a much larger thing. So I think that accepting that some debt is okay, that that's how businesses operate. And if you're like, this has debt, that doesn't necessarily mean that people will not always interpret that as bad. It matters that how much is that debt costing us? And once it starts to block future value, that's the tipping point. And then to make that ask bigger instead of smaller, so it corresponds to a lot of obvious value for the business, that can start to become more persuasive. Mm.
Before I let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of just zoom out and reflect on your own journey just a little bit. And one question I have is there something that you either learned or internalized at DoorDash that impacted or shaped the way that you approached your role at Airbnb?
Yeah, that was a big transition. What's so interesting about that transition for me is those companies were on really similar paths. They both IPO'd in the same year. And interestingly, they IPO'd on back-to-back days. So it's like they're totally different companies with totally different cultures and totally different product cultures that are both very successful. And so they're great demonstrations that there is no like right or wrong way to do things. You can be successful in any number of directions. But I think the thing that I took from DoorDash that was really valuable for me is it was a very product-led organization. And so a much deeper understanding of, all right, I can't just say like, we should do this because the flow is better or because it'll reduce cognitive load. Like, that doesn't mean anything to anyone. I need to reframe what I believe is the right thing to do in a way that makes sense to other people. And the best example I can give for this is at DoorDash, one project I worked on, which was a really strange project for a designer to work on, was to launch the entire photography system. So when I started, DoorDash had no photography and we were the only, you know, food delivery app to have no photography. And if you think about photography, it's an e-commerce, you know, standard convention, right? You want to see what you're buying, before you buy it. That's just an expectation now. With food, it's even more important because anything that I put in my body could kill me if it's not cooked properly. I really want to feel confident. And so they said, hey, Ryan, go get us photography. Not design where it goes in the app, but like create that. That was a component of this project, but it was also create like the operational flow and the style guide and hire the photographers and find out how to drum up demand and then get everything built into the app so that all of the photos end up in the right place. And I went from like, hey, Ryan, go figure this out to leading about a team of 80. We're like operations people. I had a team in India. I had photographers all around the country working remotely. And I got really good at saying like, here's why this project matters to you. And there were moments where people said, I don't think this is really valuable. You know, this A-B test didn't go well. Why are we even doing this? But there was so much momentum because the sales team was like, wow, we can use this to convert people into partners. Or the business development team was saying, wow, like we can now get McDonald's photos that they spend millions of dollars producing and drop it into our app. Or the marketing team was like, wow, we have this huge library of photos we can use for whatever we need to all the time. Where if any like one team had a question about why are we doing this, why this is valuable, there was so much momentum from other teams about, but this helps me in this way and I need this, that it was able to keep the project moving forward even when there was like various points of resistance. So, you know, really thinking about how to frame things in those ways that really matter to people was huge. One of the things that I had to totally change tactics with going to Airbnb was, you know, DoorDash was a more product-led organization, and the role of designers at the time, at least a number of years ago, was, you know, pitch PMs a variety of different ideas and then let the PMs decide what they think is going to be the most impactful for the business. And so it was kind of an agency model of like, hey, client, here's three options. Design prefers this. What do you think? You decide. And, you know, that's oversimplifying it, but that's, you know, largely how it operated. When I went to Airbnb and I tried to do that, people were like, what are you doing? And my manager literally pulled me aside and said, you don't look like you know what you're doing. Like, if, do as much process as you need to feel confident that you have the right solution, and then come in and say, I have the right solution. This is what I think is the right solution. Mm. People in meetings would be like, well, what do you think? And I was like, what do you mean? What do I think? You know? And so I think that that was a culture shift as well, where design was totally in a different position and more in the driver's seat in a design-led organization, where there were huge things I learned to emulate and continue doing at DoorDash. The other aspect of DoorDash was it was incredibly business-oriented, so I learned a lot about unit economics and specific metrics that mattered and how to account for that in my process. And then Airbnb totally flipped the script, and I had to learn some new skills, like having a stronger opinion. And, you know, and it was totally acceptable to say, like, this will reduce cognitive load. And Brian is like, okay. It's like, oh, all right. I better talk about something else then. it was a really interesting transition. And I'm glad for that, like, back-to-back combination of companies, because it was like one type of culture to a completely different type of culture. And I think that it's not uncommon for designers to have those transitions. And that's something I talk about a lot and teach a lot, is the idea of like being sensitive to that environment. If your manager at Airbnb says you don't look like you know what you're talking about, you're losing credibility in those meetings where you don't look like you know what you're talking about. So I'm like, oh, I got to change tactics here to start looking more credible, because apparently I don't. And so, you know, thinking about those transitions from culture to culture or from stage to stage of companies, I think is really interesting and a really important skill for designers to develop.
That was one of the things that jumped out to me too, was like not just the culture, but the company stage. Because I know you joined as like one of the earlier employees at DoorDash, and like that photography project exists so far outside of the traditional designer box of roles and responsibilities. Like, it's clear, you know, you're wearing a lot of hats when you're working at that earlier stage environment.
And it's up to designers to decide what type of job they want to have, right? I was very excited to be at that early stage company. I had come from Salesforce, which was 14,000 people at the time, and DoorDash was like 100 people at the time. I remember when we had like 5,000 deliveries a day, and on Sundays it would hit like 8,000, and we were so excited. And now it's like millions of deliveries a day. You know, it's like some astronomical number, which is hard to fathom. You know, I was really excited to go from this like larger environment where I was very laser focused on something very specific to something more entrepreneurial, because that just is my personality and matches my interests. And I was able to do a lot of things, you know, at Airbnb, but it was a totally different scale where we weren't building a lot of things from the ground up. And even when we're doing these large redesigns, we're like, we're going to blow up the booking flow and start over. It's not like building the very first 0-to-1 version of something the same way. So I think it's good to like recognize that these companies are different and different stages require different things from designers. And when you know that, it's really empowering because you can pick the right company for you and be like, look, I don't want to operate in swim lanes. I want to learn more about product management. I want to just jump right in and do whatever is asked of me because that's exciting to me. Cool. Then that earlier stage company is going to be great for you. If you're like, look, where I'm at right now, I just really want to focus on my craft. I really want to get good at prototyping. I really want to get good at these tools. I need to get better at, you know, integrating user research into my process. That's going to be a different type and you know, type of company where it's going to provide more focus for you to check the box on specific things you want to add to your, you know, portfolio of skills. But once you realize that, you can kind of pick your own adventure and find the right fit for you. And it's really empowering.
I want to end by talking to someone who doesn't have the business background and they're kind of listening to you talk, and maybe a little part of them is wondering, like, why does this matter? You know, why should I care about this or invest in this level of understanding? So maybe you could talk a little bit about like the role that you believe business skills will play in this next generation of designers.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. I don't advocate for what I did. I went and spent $150,000 in 3 years of my life getting my MBA. I don't think that's the right fit for everyone. I don't think that's necessary for most designers. If you want to start your own company and you're interested in entrepreneurship and business is something I was always interested in, that was the right fit for me. I don't advocate for that, but I do advocate for a greater awareness of that business context because it's the world in which you operate. Like you can not know about it, but not knowing about it is not putting you into a position to do more meaningful work. And that's really what my kind of career focus now is helping designers unlock more meaningful work for themselves. And I think when you have that context, there's a great Wayne Gretzky quote that came up at business school all the time of, I don't skate to where the puck was, I skate to where the puck is going. It's like, if you can start to anticipate, if you can start to see what the needs are, you can start to do projects in a way, or you can start to propose projects and start getting out in front. Those are the projects I always love the most, where it's like, what if we did this? That was really fun and exciting to me. And the more context you have, the better position you're going to be to do that. So I think that's one aspect. The other aspect, I think, from a larger industry perspective, is that the tech industry always goes through these cycles where it's kind of boom or bust. And we just went through one where, you know, there's a bull market for the longest bull market in American history. And the, you know, 2010s were like this great era, and Facebook is launching, and, you know, Google's, you know, really succeeding. And a lot of these companies are great, and, you know, jobs are out there and everyone's making a gazillion dollars. And then COVID happens, and then inflation happens, and it's just been like crunchy for the last number of years. I think that like 2010s era lulled us into this, you know, belief that business people totally understand design. Design is so valuable. We're feeling really great. People are hiring innovation teams, are hiring design teams. You have these huge orgs. But then when that bust time comes, you're just seeing designers get laid off like crazy. To me, that indicates that there's still this disconnect. So I do think there is always going to be a need for designers to talk about our work in a way that resonates with non-designers. And I think we have to take responsibility for that. I'll just say that right up front. If I think of design, like big D design, as a product I'm selling to people, and if they don't want to buy it, that's a problem for me. I need to reposition it. I need to reframe it. What is the value prop that is going to get that customer to purchase? That's a business problem. That's my responsibility. And if no one wants to buy your product, it doesn't really make sense to get angry at the customer. It's like, all right, that's a problem to solve, and I need to figure that out. So I think that there is this disconnect. People don't always understand, but if we can break it down for them, then it unlocks so much more meaningful work for designers. When the CEOs and the founders and the business leaders, the non-designers, suddenly get it and that light bulb goes off, that skill set is going to unlock the next generation of design leaders. I think it's going to elevate design in these organizations for anyone who can do that. And on a micro scale, I think it's going to help designers have a better day-to-day existence and work on more interesting projects. So I'm a huge proponent of it for that reason.
Well, for someone who's listening that's motivated to take the next step and learn how to communicate the value of their work, can you tell us a little bit more about your course and who's it for and what people can expect to get out of it?
Absolutely. So my course is called Describing the ROI of Design on Maven, and it is about everything we've been talking about. We go through four modules, and really it is about how do you unlock the meaning of design in your organization, regardless of what type of organization you're working in. So the first thing we do is we talk about how do you actually connect your work back to the metrics that people care about. And we'll talk about the photography project at DoorDash and saying, all right, how do we reframe our work in a way that finally unlocks people's minds and they understand it and you understand it and you're on the same team. Another aspect that's really important though is designers are not just valuable because we hit metrics for other people. There are so many things that we do culturally for the organization or from another business perspective. It's not just the result of an A/B test that we should get credit for all of the different value we deliver to a business. So we go really deep on what does that mean if it's not just A/B testing. I talk to a lot of designers who are interviewing and they're like, but we didn't launch a test, or I don't have access to that data. So how do I show that this was a valuable project? There's like 40 other ways to describe the value of the work you did that's not just the result of that A/B test. So really important to zoom out. And we talk about how do we actually, you know, kind of the second week is how do we think about these alignment things? How do we align to our businesses to build that credibility? And then once we have that credibility, most businesses are not like designed for designers. So how do we move our organizations in a way structurally or culturally to make it even possible for designers to do really cool, meaningful, impactful work? I am really excited about it. It is all the stuff that I've learned from the MBA and from DoorDash and Salesforce and Airbnb, all kind of packaged into this one thing. And it's been so fun to help designers kind of take their careers to the next level.
Quick note, if you're listening to this and you're interested in Ryan's course, I asked him to offer a discount for Dive Club community and he said yes. So head to dive.club/Ryan to save $100 on one of the top courses on all of Maven. Okay, back with the episode. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time to share some of these frameworks and just like the way that you think about different opportunities and problems and communication strategies. I mean, it's so incredibly practical. Really appreciate you taking the time to share them with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.